our time with Uncaged.
Welcome to Topple Uncaged. I'm Steve Topple, and you're locked on to the UK's hottest politics and music podcast. Each week, I bring you the rawest takes on the big stories making the news, always joined by a very special guest. Then, I pleasure your mind, body, and soul with the freshest, most banging international music going. What's up, everyone? I am Steve Topple. It is Tuesday, the 2nd of April, and that can only mean one thing. Yes, it's a slightly delayed version of this week's Topple Uncaged. Unfortunately, due to circumstances beyond my control, we were unable to get the podcast out on Sunday. But don't worry about that. I'm bringing you some of the hottest takes and some of the freshest music this week, just a bit later. I have once again got some exceptional on-the-ground reporting from Venezuela, cutting through the mainstream narrative and finding out exactly what is going on there. I have, of course, got Twitter chirps back, you giving me your views on the week's big stories, and I've only got a Grammy-nominated artist on this week's Revolutionary Birds song. What more could you want, especially on Brexit Chaos Tuesday? So, pin back your lug holes, let's get on with the show. Soaring above this week's top stories, I'm free flying with... One of the reasons I'm very proud to work at the Canary is that we have a thriving global section. We have journalists across the world bringing you these stories and the narratives that you may not hear in the mainstream press. One of our crowning achievements, I think, in the past few months has been our coverage of Venezuela, not least from my guest this week, a fellow Canary writer who is actually now on the ground in Venezuela, and he's reporting back to the Canary saying what he is seeing, which I can tell you now, and I'm sure we'll delve into a bit deeper, is not what we're being fed by the corporate press. Funny that. So I'm very pleased to welcome fellow Canary chirping with me this week on the podcast. It is John McAvoy. John, thank you so much for coming down the line from Venezuela to Blighty for me.
Thanks very much for having me, Steve.
No, it's great to have you on. You're doing great work. If you haven't read John's work on this, you need to check it out, www.thecanary.co. There is some excellent stuff and some really interesting output, which we're going to get into a bit more. John, you've been there just over a week now, haven't you? I mean, overall, kind of in broad strokes, as we discussed off air, what have you seen? I mean, overall, is the general situation in society, is it peaceful? Is it tense? Are there lots of rallies? What's your overall overarching impression of what you're seeing at the minute?
Yeah, so I'm just coming up to 2 weeks here in Caracas, in Venezuela's capital at the moment. And I mean, I was already skeptical of what we'd seen in the corporate media thus far about the humanitarian narrative, humanitarian crisis narrative, and the general depiction of Venezuelan society is on a knife edge. However, I was even more shocked when I arrived to see kind of normalcy, the normality of daily life here. I was just thinking earlier, imagining if you were transported here, you didn't know where you were going, and you just lived normal daily life without having any exposure to the news here. And if you were to find out 1 week later that this has been depicted as a humanitarian crisis, that people are starving on the streets, you'd just be bewildered. Generally, I mean, I've seen very little suffering in day-to-day life. I mean, on the streets of Caracas, and bear in mind, I'm in the west of the city at the moment, so I'm not in the east of the city, which is kind of economically and racially generally different scene. I mean, it's generally white, middle-class, European descendancy. So where I am, where the humanitarian crisis is supposedly happening, I've seen very little evidence for it. I've seen very, very little homelessness here. I mean, much, much less than I would see on the streets of London, on the streets of Birmingham, where I'm from, for instance. And people are obviously struggling. I mean, the economic crisis is quite literally strangling the country. However, people are kind of figuring out ways to get by it. There's various different governmental schemes and local community projects that are resisting what's coming.
Yeah, yeah. We'll get into community projects later, because like I said in the introduction, you did a fantastic article on about one of them. We'll talk about that a bit more. I mean, this is obviously no surprise for myself, and it's probably no surprise for some of our listeners that what you're experiencing, and this is very similar to what Greystone Project journalist Max Blumenthal told me twice when I interviewed him when he was on the ground in Venezuela and when he came back. It's completely different to the narrative we're being fed. I mean, you and I know as well as most people that the narrative we're being fed is, of course, a textbook play drama, if you like, with the same actors and the same script that goes back to at least the 1950s with the Guatemala coup for the United Fruit Company. I mean, we've been here so many times before, it's unbelievable, but obviously they feel they can still push this narrative. On the ground, are people aware of what is going on outside of Venezuela with regards to this basically US corporatist-backed coup? Are they aware of the agendas that are at play outside the borders of Venezuela?
Yeah, on the grand scheme, people are quite incredibly aware of the kind of inner functioning of US foreign policy. In my general experience thus far, people are much more aware of US foreign policy than most Americans I've ever met.
They often talk about
Guatemala and Vietnam, but one thing that they talk about quite often as well is Nicaragua. And after the Sandinista Revolution in 1979 in Nicaragua, I mean, the U.S. essentially saw Nicaragua and the Sandinista government as incompatible with its imperialist vision for what Latin America should look like. And what happened in Nicaragua is very similar to what's happening here. I mean, aside from the terrorist operation that the US was funding through the Contras, there was also a mega economic war going on in Nicaragua to essentially suffocate the economy. I've also spoken with a lot of opposition supporters and opposition leaders, young leaders of the Popular Will Party, Juan Guaido's party. And yeah, I mean, they basically say that the supporters of the government are using the economic sanctions as a way to say that the government is basically faultless, that they're blameless for what's going on in the society. So there are obviously two sides to this, but the only side we're hearing at the moment is that of the opposition.
So, I mean, on the ground, how is that? How are you seeing it? As you say, in the east of the city is more the sort of white middle class areas, which are the sort of, I would imagine, the Guaido supporters. And then you're in a more working class area where the support, I imagine, is for Maduro. Is that how the politics is divided, if you like? Is that what you're seeing?
You could generally describe it as that, yeah. But, I mean, There is still a sizable amount of support for the opposition, even in the west of the city as well, because people, I mean, it's exactly what happened in Nicaragua. People are getting sick of the situation in this country, and they're basically losing faith in their government's means to deal with it. However, yeah, I would say the majority of the people here are either government supporters, or they're so opposed to the projects of US imperialism that they would vote for the government as to not give them an inlet into the country.
That's a really interesting take on that, actually, because I'm pleased you said all that, because quite often what was, especially over here, as you know, with a lot of the independent left-wing press, what was sometimes seen for me personally is a bit too much of erring on the side of unflappable support for Maduro when things aren't necessarily perfect by any stretch of the imagination with him, and to paint it as sort of very basic terms of either Maduro support or Guaido support and that's it. It's obviously not the case. It is, of course, far more nuanced than that, if you like.
Something I'd like to add on that as well is a lot of the people that originally supported the Bolivarian Revolution and the new constitution of 1999 that Hugo Chavez implemented in the country, is that the goal was actually to devolve much power from the Venezuelan government to colectivos. So the idea wasn't essentially a blind support for the government as it isn't now. Many of them are actually very frustrated with the amount of bureaucratization in the Venezuelan government at the moment. I mean, if you take all of the names for the ministries at the moment, for example, they're all called ministries of popular power for education, for health, or whatever. And many people are very frustrated that they don't actually see that popular power in the ministries at the moment. And what they actually want is more devolution from the government to the popular communities.
No, it's an excellent take, and it's very refreshing to hear, like I say, that the actual nuance that is actually going on, as opposed to just these polarised opinions. Moving on, the current blackouts, I mean, these seem to have been going on for ages now, and obviously your latest article, which people can read at www.thecanary.co, is saying that Maduro's administration are accusing are saying it's sabotage. I mean, I can't believe they're still ongoing, actually, to be honest. What's your take on, is Maduro's government right? Is it do you think it is sabotage? What are you seeing on the ground there?
Well, I actually received a report from the Guri down there, from the Simon Bolivar electrical plant, from someone that was there that said that they'd found, that they'd found suspicious items at the scene of the explosion. And the communications minister, Jorge Ramirez, I believe, also said that an event like this has never actually happened, an explosion and a fire of this scale in the electrical plant has never actually happened. So that Not to take reports that are probably government-backed reports on the ground at heart, but it would be wild to not consider the possibility of sabotage, given the CIA and the US's role of covert operations throughout not just this continent but various others. I mean, in 1972 against Chilean President Salvador Allende, there were similar electrical blackouts. And we've also seen the secret memo that. Sorry, this, the memo that was released by WikiLeaks that basically detailed a plan that if there were a collapse at the Simon Bolivar plant in the Simon Bolivar about 8 hours from Caracas, then that could be a galvanizing moment to kind of provoke public unrest in the country. And that's exactly what the opposition are doing. So we take that memory, it looks like it's going exactly to plan if there was sabotage. You also have to consider as well that there is a literal, or at least an objective sabotage happening at the moment, because even the New York Times buried this in one of their articles, that US economic sanctions are actually having an effect on the government's ability to deal and to maintain this electrical plant. So there's at least at this present time, there's at least an objective argument to make that outside interference is causing, or at least having a negative impact on these blackouts at the moment. And on the ground, they're having an incredibly debilitating effect. People can't use their credit cards in a society that's becoming more and more cashless with the inflation at the moment. People can't take the metro in Caracas, where around 2 million people are taking the metro every day, and now that's completely impossible. So people aren't working, people aren't in schools. I mean, it's having an incredible effect. Yeah, it's having an incredibly negative effect on the country at the moment.
That's very, very, very interesting. It seems like it's been going on for absolutely ages. I want to move on to what I mentioned earlier regarding. It's fascinating what you said actually about how the people actually want still more devolved power, and that it never really materialised. Because there's a brilliant story you wrote on the 26th of March, I believe, which is about a community project that's fighting back, as you put it, against US imperialism using music and the arts. And this is, I mean, this has sort of resonance for me around the world, really, globally. This is the kind of initiatives and the kind of movements we should be seeing as a species all over. But just for people listening at home, tell them a brief overview of what this community project was and what you saw when you went and visited it, because it's fascinating.
So there's an area in Caracas called San Agustin, and basically in 2013 the government devolved power to them to renovate a theatre that had fallen into complete disrepair. And so the community got together there, they completely renovated the theatre, took it into their own hands. Now they've created a radio station at the top of the theatre, and they have kind of community events, children's dance shows, dance classes, music instrument teaching, whatever you want. And so at the moment, the importance of, for me at least, the way I see the importance of these projects here is that in the current economic context of the country, community solidarity is so important, and these kind of projects like what they're doing there are showing devolved power to the popular classes can function and be a complete success. And also when the community gets together, that there's a general solidarity that is basically the front, that the way I see it at the moment, is the front line against US imperialism, because the end goal in my analysis of the economic sanctions, of backing Guaido, of essentially backing a coup in the country, is to divide the country and create civil unrest and turn people against each other. And so there's various community projects that are at the center of actually keeping these communities together, to basically not crumble under the massive weight of US imperialism at the moment.
No, it sounds excellent, and as I say, I mean, that should be replicated in every town, city, and village across the world. But that's for another podcast. Just to wrap up, really, I mean, it's fascinating that you say that in some respects life has sort of been carrying on, and as you say, people are well aware of what's going on outside of Venezuelan borders with regards to the situation. I mean, sort of the money shot question is, do you think, firstly, that the coup is now effectively dead in the water, and secondly, do you think that Maduro and his administration can maintain power? So two-part question, please.
What I worry is two things. Firstly, is that the US has essentially been humiliated in Venezuela. The humanitarian aid narrative basically fell flat on its face on the 23rd of February. They didn't manage to get into the country. The military didn't defect. And even, I mean, I'm not gonna commend the New York Times for doing it, but even when the New York Times are basically going against your narrative, then you know you're in a kind of bad situation. When the New York Times published a piece basically saying this humanitarian aid narrative where the trucks trying to enter the Venezuelan territory were burned by government forces, ended up to be a complete lie. So I worry that the longer this goes on, the more the US empire becomes humiliated by what's going on here. Secondly, I also worry about the essential war of attrition that's going on here. As days go by, the US is finding more reasons, like it needs them anyway, to increase sanctions on economic sanctions on this country, and you can visibly see how it's strangling the economy. So I think the pressure, and I mean, at the same time, you've also got the US that's trying to telling countries like India that they can't buy Venezuelan oil. So it's going to become more and more and more and more difficult for Venezuelans. And I mean, like you saw in Nicaragua again, what they essentially said is, if we can't have our own government in Nicaragua, we will just let them fester in their own problems. So it's if the US doesn't get its way, I feel like it's going to turn into a form of collective punishment for ever trying to go against the socio-economic project of the US and the Americas.
I think it's a very good analysis. I think it's all very it's very easy to take what Trump says and what's going on the face of it as red, but as you say, I suppose it's more the kind of the corporate deep state in America is not just going to roll over and take this. I don't think it's over by any stretch of the imagination, and they can't be seen to have been made a fool of, as you point out, in Venezuela. So I'm with you on that. I don't think there's particularly any end to this in sight, and I don't think there's any decent resolution.
And just to add two minor additional things, there's also the formation of new narratives once the old ones become debunked. So at the moment we've got the narrative that the Russians are now in Venezuela, the Russian military is now in Venezuela, which goes directly contrary to what the US is literally saying that they're using at the moment, the Monroe Doctrine, which essentially says, this is our backyard, this is where we play, this is our imperial project, and nobody else should come here. So you've got that new narrative forming, and I mean, just today, I think like 3 hours ago, Juan Guaido, their puppet, has been told that he can't hold office for another 15 years. So that's going to be a new narrative of a new attempt to say, look at this dictatorship. Whereas, I mean, if you look at the US, if you take Nancy Pelosi, tried to get Russian backing to organize a coup in the US, I'd be amazed if she was still alive today. And if she were still alive, I wouldn't be surprised if she was up for execution. So yeah, I mean, you've got as new old narratives die, you've got new narratives, and this isn't going to end anytime soon.
Completely agree. John, absolutely fascinating analysis. You're very, very, because we've never actually spoken properly in real life before. It's just been typing in the newsroom. Fascinating. Extremely erudite. My kind of chat to a journalist, this one. That was absolutely brilliant analysis. Fascinating to speak to you. How much longer are you there for?
I actually don't know. Maybe a week. It could be longer. I haven't figured it out yet. So, yeah, we'll see.
All right. Well, keep up the excellent work. And like I say, you need to, guys, check out John's reporting on the Canary live from the ground of Venezuela. For the moment, John McAvoy, thank you so much for coming on Topple Uncaged.
Cheers for having me, Steve.
Time for you guys to be uncaged because Twitter chirps back. Right, you lot, yes, this is your section. I gave up on question time, as I know a lot of you have, and I've turned it over to you. It is Twitter chirps back, where I give you a tweet and you tell me what top stories you think I should be talking about while everyone else ignores them that are going on behind the scenes. First off, my mate Lisa McKenzie. Yes, hello, Lisa. She was a guest on the podcast a little while back, actually. Excellent. She was absolutely stunning. Rebel ethnographer, all-round working-class academic. She says we need to be talking about child poverty, housing poverty, pensioner poverty, in-work poverty, and decreasing life expectancy. Yes, absolutely, Lisa. You're spot on. All these issues are happening in spite of Brexit, not because of it, for example, and have been rumbling away for decades. These are, of course, all part of a wider agenda, in my opinion, one that's hurtling towards a dystopian future for us, and is all part of increasing corporatist capitalism. But yep, Lisa, all these issues keep happening and they are ruining the lives of millions of people in this country. Good call. Over to my mate Merlin. Merlin Norbury. Hello, Merlin. He's an excellent filmmaker. I made a couple of films with him actually in 2017 for The Canary. You can check them out on my YouTube. Merlin says, the UK isn't only selling weapons to Saudi. It's UK and US ships that are involved in the blockade causing the Yemen famine. It's our military that's involved in starving a whole country's people. It's not just about the weapon sales, as the press in the UK would have us believe. Absolutely, you're spot on. There is so much twisting of the narrative surrounding Yemen. Although a lot of people praise the BBC and praise The Guardian for its coverage, quite often it's extremely insipid, painting it as an issue of arms sales to the country and ignoring some of the wider geopolitical forces that are at play. I mean, at least what's rarely reported is the situation with the Al-Mandab Strait, a waterway next to Yemen, which is one of the world's biggest all-shipping transport lines. Of course, the fact that if the Houthis actually won the war in Yemen and took control of the country, it would be in their hands. Well, no, that's never mentioned. Never mind the geopolitical implications of that. Paula Peters, Deepak activist, says, poor doors, segregation of housing estates. Yeah, there's a huge story on this a couple of weeks ago, actually. Paula, you're quite right. A Labour council once again turning a regeneration scheme into essentially some more social cleansing, where it's having one set of doors for the rich on an estate and one set of doors for the poor. Speak to Lisa McKenzie about this one as well. But yep, good call, Paula. Like that as well. Interesting comment. Anne McGarry Marsden. Hello, Anne, says, who watches TV these days? Well, actually, yes, this is very true. We very rarely have television on in the Topple Jeffrey household, to be perfectly honest. What do we watch on TV? We always watch EastEnders, I have to say that. We no longer watch Question Time. Oh, Fleabag. That's what we watch. It's our favourite comedy on the minute. Great comedy. Part of BBC Three, which airs, I believe, on Monday night on BBC One, if my memory serves me correctly. Love Fleabag. It's brilliant. We're also a bit of a Family Guy and American Dad addict as well. We like those. But otherwise, nope, we don't watch much television either, Anne. Lustitia says, hello Lustitia, she says homelessness, yes, that's still obviously a major issue in this country. Catherine says, we should reiterate the points made by Alston UNSR, that's Philip Alston from the UN, in his report on the visit to the UK, and she gives the link to Philip Alston's report. He was the UN rapporteur on extreme poverty, who gave a damning report last year. The link is in Catherine's tweet, it'll be in the show notes. And someone called Toussaint, hello Toussaint, sounds a bit French to me, Toussaint, he says, media distortion, lies, false context and propaganda in the context of indie media, censorship, the possible imminent arrest of Julian Assange and the collapse of Russiagate. Yeah, there's been a lot going on with the Mueller investigation, hasn't there? There's some very interesting information coming out about that. Media distortion, lies, false context and propaganda in the context of indie media. I have no idea what that's about. Except I have one little song to finish this section, and it goes something like... Boo! I'm saying nothing more. Thank you so much for your comments this week, and Twitter chirps back. Don't worry, it will be back next week, so make sure you check out my Twitter on a Thursday evening just before question time, where I will put out a tweet and you can get things off your chest to me. In the meantime, here comes a Grammy-nominated musician. And here's this week's banger in Revolutionary Birdsong. Oh my gosh. My guest on this week's podcast is a musical genius. Nearly 15 years since his first release. Last year he dropped an album which absolutely blew up, topping charts around the world, receiving international critical acclaim, not least a Grammy nomination to boot, and moreover, moving the Roots Revival movement into uncharted territory. One of the hottest acts at the minute, Coffee cites him as an inspiration and as a singer, rapper, songwriter, lyricist, producer, arranger, and numerous other talents. He is inspirational. I'm really humbled to have him as a guest on my Topple Uncaged podcast. It's so exciting, and I'm so pleased to introduce the incredible Protégé. Protégé, thank you so much for coming on. It is a real, real pleasure to have you on the podcast.
Yeah, man, no doubt. Give thanks, bro. Give thanks.
Thank you. So, I mean, 2018, it was a huge year for you. Obviously, the album A Matter of Time, as I said in the introduction, blew up across the world. It was such a success. In 2019, you've already started touring. Looking back to 2005, when you dropped your first major release, which was a mixtape, the Lyrical Overdose Volume 1, did you think that it would ever get to this level and this stage for you? Were you expecting it to, and you as an artist, to blow up like this?
I mean, I don't even, like, back then it was just me trying to do something and try to find a way to just hear what I sounded like. You know, you couldn't get into studios or anything, so that was me not being able to get beats or doing anything but just downloading stuff. But yes, I always had a dream that I'd progress into an international artist. It's always been a goal, so I can't say that I'm surprised. You know, I just expected to be where I'm at and further.
And, I mean, where you're at is amazing. As I said, A Matter of Time was, I don't want to call it an album, really. It was an overarching project, and it was absolutely huge. We'll get into the musicality and the more conscious elements of it later on. But why do you think it became such a successful project? Is there one thing you can pin down, or was it something more broadly, do you think, that made people just feel it? Because it's an album which you listen to it and it immediately almost grabs hold of your soul, in my opinion, and touches you. Why do you think it was such a success?
I just think people, you know, started, like, the songs from it were good. It started off with Blood Money, that started off with a vibe, and then the sounds were just different. And I think people just always wanted to try to hear something different and new, and I think A Matter of Time had that. And then on top of it as well, I just think that I've grown and got, you know, more global and traveling to more places, so the music gets to reach more people. So I think that all of those factors combine.
Absolutely. And I think the growth, if you like, of an artist is particularly kind of relevant to A Matter of Time, because it was a fascinating project musically. I mean, I want to kind of, if you look back to your first proper album release, which was A 7 Year Itch, it was eclectic, and it was kind of, for me listening to it, you were almost reintroducing roots to the 21st century, if you like, because it had reggae sensibilities, but then you were breaking the mold of that somewhat and already setting out how you were as an artist, and the kind of diversity and eclecticism that you do. I mean, it still sounds fresh today. I put it on this afternoon and it feels like it could be in 2019. But then when you compare it to A Matter of Time, and I don't say experimental for A Matter of Time, because I don't think that's quite the right word, but it was such a musically eclectic and diverse album, which represented this real progression as an artist from the Seven Year Itch. Can I ask for you, is that progression and that eclecticism something that has always been there? Because I know both your parents were musicians, your father was a Calypso King. Is it something that's always been there, or has it something that developed since A Seven Year Itch and the subsequent releases from that? Where has this brilliant eclecticism come from?
I mean, just growing up in music, and for me, it's like I've always wanted to try things musically, but I've always wanted to take my time as well. You know, like, there's so many sounds that I've had for so long that I just haven't, I don't want to say been able to do them, but just have been conscious of like, gradually moving the music forward so it doesn't shock. And so that it's like you're serving like a meal, but you don't want to just, you know, you want to give somebody like something like they're used to first, and then you say, hey, try this, but by that time they're already enjoying their meals and they're feeling really good, so they're like, okay, let me go with it. And then, and especially with Jamaica and just with my role, what my role has been to reggae music, I wanted to grade it just forward slowly but surely, you know.
How important is it? Because I speak to a lot of artists, and some of them say that, well, we have to strike a balance between doing tracks which are very conscious and that have a message that we want to get across to people, to the listeners, but also balance that with tracks which are going to make people feel good and which are essentially songs which can be listened to without much thinking behind them. I mean, how important is it to you to make conscious music? How high up does that right for you?
It's not even, I just look at it more just start singing and writing about the things that I think about. So it's like, for me, it's just being myself and really and truly just singing about the things I talk about. Now obviously I do talk about other things that I don't put into music, but I'm comfortable with this, I'm comfortable with it. Music lives forever. I want to have an impact. I want to, if I'm having a conversation with somebody, I'd like them to feel inspired after. At the same time, I mean, music should be fun and light, because there is a certain level of depth to lightness. You know what I mean? It's like you can find the simplest of ways to inspire. So it doesn't have to be. You know, conscious for me is a word that, you know, the meaning is relative, you know. So if I do a song like Bout Noon, I'm expressing how I feel about my girl. I mean, to me, that's conscious, you know. So it's all relative. So I don't like to judge what other artists do and what they sing about, because everybody should be free. But I just sing about what I feel, and I think it works, and people are able to connect with it.
There's always a kind of it's a kind of chicken and egg question for me. Are mainstream outlets not playing more conscious music because the system won't let them, or are they not playing it because people aren't listening to it, therefore there's no demand for it? And what do you think on that? Which is it, do you think?
I think that's a good analysis. I think it's a mixture of both. But I do think it has been systematic over the past, since the artist wasn't able to break out themselves. Like, now it's much easier with YouTube, with Spotify, with things for people to get music. And I think that the challenge has always been make, you know, the music that we're making very palatable for youth. And I think with something like, say, Coffee now, who is you know, young and fresh, doing her thing, and she is what you would call mainstream. You know, she is mainstream with a positive sound. It's not traditional reggae, but that's also dope that she doesn't have to do that, and she can just put her sounds out there. So, as I say, no, who knows what's mainstream? It's possible. It's definitely possible, and it shows that people will listen to this type of music if they're given the chance, or or if there's visibility. So I just think it's to keep it fresh, and there's no real complaint. You know, it's just to keep making it fresh and, you know, doing what you can do to reach out there.
No, absolutely. And you touched on something I wanted to ask you next. You were one of the, I suppose, I don't want to say pioneers, maybe that's not the right word, but you sort of led the revival movement back when it started in sort of the early part of this decade. And it's changed so much. I mean, when you look at the amount of artists out there, the diversity of what people are doing, both musically and lyrically. And then when you, this year already, we have, as you pointed out, seen Coffee really break through and manage to break through into that mainstream. I mean, she's going to blow up this year. She's going to be absolutely huge. How does it feel as someone who was there back in the day, as it were, to see how it's now become such a overarching, such a huge and important, but also phenomenally exceptionally good movement? How do you feel about that? How does it feel for you?
It feels good. It feels really good because I always told people that, you know, like, give us 10 years to change the culture and to make that impact. And as I sit and look at it now in 2019, as I say, with the success of, overwhelming success of Coffee, and who definitely like grew up on my music, and Lila Ike, and, you know, like obviously the success of Chronix as well, who to me is like such a brilliant artist and has done so much for music as well. You know, Kabaka touring, you know, Jesse, like I feel Jana, and it feels really good because we all just started out, and just to see it now, I would say 8 years later, it feels really good. And then to also know that there's still gas in the tank, you know what I mean? Like, nobody is finished yet, just looking for health and strength and to make sure that we continue to bring the music further.
I'm not sure what else you can really do at the minute, because you've had a huge album, you've just been touring, but have you got anything else lined up for 2019, or are you just going to have a rest?
No, you have no idea what's coming for 2019. I'm building my studio right now up in the hills in Kingston, and I have a lot of music, bro. I have a lot of music, and I'm not waiting 3 years in between albums again. I'm not even waiting 2 years in between albums again. I have lots of music to come this year. I have lots of music from myself, from Lila Ike, from Savannah. Music with me and Lila, with me and Savannah, like, it's gonna be a very interesting year this year. It's the last year of the decade. It's the closing out of an era of music, and I want to make sure that my presence is definitely felt this year.
Well, that is music to my ears, Protégé, that you're doing that. So I'm looking forward to that already. It's been absolutely fantastic speaking to you. Fascinating insights as always, and really, really interesting to hear about where you've come from and where you're going to. It's been great to talk to you. Protégé, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Take care, brother, all right?
How amazing is Protégé? Oh my gosh. So thoughtful, considered, deep, philosophical, and of course a legend when it comes to music, lyricism, and production and arrangement. He is just amazing. Matter of Time was just amazing. And here is one of my favourite tracks from the album. It is the opening one, the overarching cinematic, then into a bit of East Coast hip-hop, Flames, featuring the fantastic Chronix. This is Flames featuring Chronix.
can't get it tonight, find them kryptonite then. Man up are like Superman, one or group a man stand up right beside them. Come through with a new pattern, inna the suit of them, man you a shoot and a miss. Start up with thunder, flash the lightning, fire start sing a song reciting. Fire side night with all the hydrin, fire subscribe them, start the writing. Oh look at how them want us fighting, distracted with advertising. Control the brain with all the choices, and now them want control ganja prices. Not a bumbo plant as long as I live, I face freedom can't fuck like this.
Remember everything is everything, yeah. Nothing to lose and everything to gain. So we burn them again and again and again and again. Anything or anything. Remember everything is everything, yeah. Nothing to lose and everything to gain. So we burn them again, again and again. Babylon in a flame.
When the government can't fight crime, they blame cartel or blame alkaline. Warm to the parents, them when I try to tell the youth, them make up them own mind. Happy think deeper, overstand me. All of these thoughts are underhanded. Like all a man, like Bustamante. Oh, you forget me, trust a man, de. National hero, who you turn them. You share a band, water run them. None of them thing, no teaching at the school. Them take man for fool, you know the plan them. But where they want them when I compromise? Start talk truth, so them are comfy. A eye for your eye, or a tooth for your tooth. Till your mouth full of gum and your food, no get
cheap. Everything is everything. Nothing to lose and everything.
And that's it. Episode 20 of Topple Uncaged is done. I'd like to thank my fantastic guest this week, the incredible John McAvoy. Follow him on Twitter. It's at JMcAvoy2. Also, the incomparable Protege. Follow him on Twitter. It's at Protege. As always, behind the scenes, thank you to the love of my life, the gorgeous Nicola Jeffrey. Follow her on Twitter. It's at Nicholas C. Jeffrey. My man in the booth, sound engineer Gav Pauls. Follow him on Twitter. It's at Pauls with the Z Radio. And my in-house singer, it's Ray Star Music. Follow her on Twitter. It's at Ray_Star113. I promise you, normal service will resume next Sunday morning. Topple Uncaged, back to full pelt.
Okay.